Good morning. Glad to be here again, and I appreciate everyone who came today. I didn't get the scripture reading into the bulletin in time this week, but it's a familiar reading of the parable of talents. You'll find it, if you wish, on page 38 of the New Testament in the Bible, in the Pew Bible. It's Matthew chapter 25, starting in verse 14. I'll abbreviate slightly. A man going on a journey summoned his slaves and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went away. The one who had received the 5 talents went off at once and traded with them and made 5 more talents. In the same way, the one who had the 2 talents made 2 more. But the one who had received the 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled the accounts with them. Then the one who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and trustworthy slave. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master." And so it went with the servant with 2 talents. Then the one who had received 1 talent came forward saying, "Master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not scatter. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours." But his master replied, "You wicked and lazy slave, you knew, did you, that I reap where I do not sow and gather where I do not scatter? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I would have received what was my own with interest. So take this talent from him and give it to the one with 10 talents. For to all who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away." With this enigmatic note, the children may leave and ponder it in their own program. I hope to conduct some housekeeping today, maybe it should be called church keeping, regarding the annual financial update for Berkeley Friends Church, and also go a little further with exploring the English Reformation, which I started in late September. But first, let's take a look at the scripture reading. The parable of the talents is one of those troubling parables, particularly the punchline, "To those who have shall more be given, and from those who lack shall be taken away what little they have." I have discussed this parable previously, so I won't go through a long explanation. The usual solution to this apparent unfairness of the punchline is to spiritualize the parable by identifying the slave master with God and interpreting the talents as spiritual gifts, an idea that fits comfortably with the English idiom of the word talent. The message seems to be that the stronger you are in the spirit and the more obedient you are to God, the more you will grow in spirit and in faith, and the more talents God will give you. That interpretation is credible, salutary, and very familiar. However, another approach entirely is to accept the parable as patently unfair. Rather than being a metaphorical story about God, it is an apt description of the unfairness of life under Roman occupation in Palestine. The version of this parable told in Luke in chapter 19 fits this interpretation even better than does the account in Matthew. In Luke's version, the slave master goes abroad to be granted royal powers. This is, in fact, how power was delegated in the Roman Empire. Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great, sailed from Palestine to Rome to be installed as the ruler of northern Palestine where Jesus lived. Luke adds another detail that Matthew omits. Luke says that the people objected to having this ruler imposed upon them. This detail restores the voice of the people who are the missing ingredient in Matthew's version of the parable. Luke concludes the parable with a different punchline altogether. The royal slave master says, "These enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slay them in my presence." So the people who heard Jesus tell his parable in the third decade of the first century would not need a degree in theology to understand that Jesus was describing the situation they lived and faced in their day-to-day lives. Far from being a stand-in for God, the slave master with royal power was Herod Antipas himself, and the parable of the talents depicts the kingdom of Caesar, where indeed the poor lost more and more until they were homeless and destitute. Hence, this is a parable about wheeling and dealing in the royal palace and the resulting poverty on the street corner. In our era, it would be about Wall Street versus Main Street. Eventually, the growing desperation in Palestine would erupt into a civil war and lead to the fall of Jerusalem, about 30 years after this parable was told. As we will see, a similar situation took place again during the English Reformation, which culminated in the English Revolution almost 400 years ago. Before we get to the English Reformation, however, let me first turn to the financial update on Berkeley Friends Church. This is an annual update that the Clerk of Stewardship and Finance provides. I thought that a financial parable would dovetail with a financial report. The present update is fairly encouraging, so encouraging that we don't really need to spend much time on it. The good news is that the level of giving in 2018 has been high. The total church income has been over $150,000. About a half of this is from donations. Income thus far has already surpassed our expectation for the entire year. Some of this surplus has been due to large donations from a few individuals. This is something to celebrate, and at the same time, it is cautionary to consider whether the church could survive if these large donors disappear. So rather than ask you to give more money to BFC, I would prefer to ask you to invite more people to visit BFC, and with the hope that maybe some of them would join or attend on a regular basis. By all means, give more money to Berkeley Friends Church if you can do so, but it would be of equal value to attract more people to join the congregation. Berkeley Friends Church could use additional funds, but having more people to share the work of the congregation would be equal and perhaps of greater value. Well, that is the annual update. If you want more details, please review the annual budget that has been circulated at the monthly business meeting. Now, let's get on to the English Revolution and Reformation. In the last installment, at the beginning of October, I pointed out that many changes were taking place during the Reformation era in England. Henry VIII had privatized land that formerly belonged to monasteries, and this gradually led to the displacement of much of the rural English population. So when you see those pictures of England today with those nifty pastures surrounded by stone walls, that is not what it looked like in the early Reformation period. Those places were villages filled with people trying to eke out a survival through agriculture. In addition, the silver and gold from Mexico and Peru, stolen by the Spanish, produced inflation throughout Europe, adding to the misery of the poor and requiring even the well-to-do to cut back on ostentatious displays of wealth. It also caused landowners to raise rents as high as they could sustain them. Meanwhile, after Elizabeth replaced Mary as the Queen of England in 1558, the country was flooded with many editions of the Geneva Bible, which presented an unvarnished Calvinist interpretation. Most people who could read soon possessed a copy of the Geneva Bible. Before the reign of Elizabeth, access to the Bible was severely limited and often punished harshly. During her reign, the only Bible readily available was the Geneva Bible. This produced a sharp rise in Calvinism in England. And these Calvinists would eventually be labeled as Puritans. However, under Elizabeth's reign, they often identified themselves as the godly. These godly Christians formed the main body of the Low Church Anglicans, distinct from the High Church, which focused on the pomp and lavish music at Westminster Abbey and St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Outside of London, most parishes followed a fairly sober liturgy, drawing music from the Calvinist tradition, with no church organ. Elizabeth herself sided with the High Church faction of the Church of England and did what she could to restrain Calvinist influences. Nevertheless, Calvinism flourished. The spread of Calvinism in England was also aided by the universities, in particular Cambridge, which became a center for training Calvinist ministers, while Oxford was a center for the High Church Anglicans. A great many people were involved in these activities, but one of the key figures was William Perkins, a professor at Oxford and a minister in the Oxford parish. He was born shortly after the coronation of Elizabeth, and he died at the age of 42, 1 year prior to Elizabeth's death, at the age of 70. While we think of that other William with the surname Shakespeare as the definitive spokesperson for Elizabethan England, it is likely that William Perkins enjoyed much more influence in that era through his sermons and his legacy of training Calvinist ministers at Oxford University. Perkins promoted the standard Calvinist tropes, such as salvation by faith alone and predestination to either heaven or hell, but he refined some of Calvin's ideas. Perkins maintained that the reprobate, those who were destined for hell, could at times be granted temporary faith, which was indistinguishable from saving faith, but would avail them nothing in the final judgment. They were still bound for hell. While this seems to be a particularly sadistic twist of theology, Perkins may have sensed that some Christians just did not get with the program. And indeed, Jesus says something about this too in the Sermon on the Mount. He says in chapter 7, verse 21, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who do the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name cast out demons and in your name perform many miracles?' And then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you.'" This point is relevant to Quakers as well, because Quakers accepted the concept of temporary faith. They maintained that the decision to follow the gospel is a daily choice and not a once-and-done conversion experience. As Jesus had said, "Take up your cross daily and follow me." Perkins was also one of the first people to use the term experimental faith in a way that would be replicated by George Fox about 60 years later. George Fox says about his experience of Revelation, "This I knew experimentally," referring to a vivid subjective experience of communication with God. So this was an established usage long before George Fox used it. Another theological idea that Perkins refined was the concept of a calling, an idea that goes back to Luther, but took on new significance under Calvin. While Luther reduced the number of Christian sacraments from 7 to 2, leaving baptism and communion, he surreptitiously added a calling to the list of Christian necessities. The calling is an avenue of practical service which a person should dedicate his or her life to. Today, in many evangelical churches, you may hear it said that God has a plan for your life. This is also not foreign to Quaker practice, where a similar concept is called a leading. However, the difference is not everyone is expected to have a leading, whereas Calvinists expected everyone to have a calling. Also, leadings may be short-term assignments, while callings are lifelong endeavors. Here is what Perkins had to say about this necessity in his treatise of Vocations, or the Callings of Men. Every person of every degree, state, sex, or condition, without exception, must have some personal and particular calling to walk in. Five types of persons break this rule: rogues, beggars, and vagabonds. 2, monks and friars. 3, gentlemen, enriched with great livings and revenues, who spend their days in eating and drinking and do not serve the church or the commonwealth. 4, servants, who should have some other particular calling unless they attend on men of great place and state. 5, papists, in general, who have added 52 saint days to the 52 Sabbaths appointed by God, and so spend more than a quarter of a year in rest and idleness. In addition to these theological efforts, Perkins is significant for taking strong positions on social policy in Elizabethan England. In particular, he defended the harsh legislation of that era regarding the poor. As we noted previously, a great many people were displaced from the English countryside over the course of the 16th century in order to make room for the raising of sheep to produce wool for export. These displaced people were called vagabonds. We also noted that one effect of the Reformation in England was to replace the Catholic calendar, which had up to 5 months of holidays in the course of the year, with the Protestant calendar, which only recognized Sunday as the day of rest, included a few church festivals such as Christmas and Easter. The Puritans would eventually reject Christmas and Easter as well, thus restricting the number of holidays to less than 2 months of the annual calendar. In contrast, in America today, we typically have slightly less than 4 months of holidays per year. The effect of the Protestant calendar was that people worked more days in the course of the year, so fewer people would need to be hired, and this would make employment even harder to find when there was already a surplus of vagabonds wandering the countryside looking for work. Hence, the Protestant calendar made it harder to find work. Consequently, the number of homeless vagabonds became a pressing problem both to manage and also to define the limits of public responsibility or private charity. As you may suspect, the bonds of charity were rather meager, and the language used to defend those bonds might strike you as remarkably familiar with today's political discourse. Too much easy charity was seen as demoralizing. Perkins wrote, "It is the good law of our land, agreeable to the law of God, that none should beg that are able to labor. The only hope of salvation for the poor is to be set on work in order to be restored to a disciplined community, and the promise of salvation offered through the church." Just as the term welfare queen became popularized in the 1980s, an equivalent term in Elizabethan England was the sturdy rogue. This meant someone young and capable of work who was unable or refused to find steady work, but instead lived by their wits through begging and trickery. Much of Elizabethan social policy was intended to distinguish the sturdy rogue from the deserving poor who were unable to work due to physical disability. A series of laws were issued to regulate the poor in England during the reign of Elizabeth from 1572 to 1601. It gave the justice of the peace authority to register the poor on the basis of age and disability. Unregistered beggars without a disability were to be whipped and branded through the ear and sent back to their hometown, which they had left because they had no work there. A second offense as an unregistered vagabond was punishable by death. On the bright side of the ledger, the entire population was expected to contribute money to poor relief, destined only for the deserving elderly and impotent poor. And the refusal to contribute was punishable by fines or imprisonment. Later in the 16th century, Parliament set up almshouses for the disabled poor and houses of corrections for sturdy rogues to teach them work skills. Undoubtedly, the houses of correction employed thrashings and other tortures to instill the proper enthusiasm for underpaid labor. This is not altogether different from today, where a large number of unemployed youth are incarcerated for crimes of youthful indiscretion. William Perkins considered the poor laws of his era to be an excellent statute, and being in substance the very law of God, is never to be repealed. In fact, the Elizabethan poor laws remained in effect for over two centuries, but they were moderated somewhat when sturdy rogues could be shipped off to the British colonies for cheap labor as indentured servants. But Britain had no colonies during Elizabeth's reign. This leaves us with that perplexing parable of the talents and how we might respond to this stark and accurate depiction of life in Roman Palestine, in Elizabethan England, and increasingly in today's America. We each have to come to our own conclusions. But I'll close with some words from Dorothy Day, the journalist and co-founder of Catholic Worker, who has given these matters a good deal of attention. Dorothy was certainly not a fan of William Perkins, yet there is some overlap in their thinking. Among her writings, she had this to say: "Poverty is a strange and elusive thing. I condemn poverty and I advocate it. Poverty is simple and complex at once. It is a social phenomena and a personal matter. We need always to be thinking and writing about it, for if we are not among its victims, its reality fades from us. We must talk about poverty because people insulated by their own comfort lose sight of it. The gospel takes away our right to discriminate between the deserving and the undeserving poor. Even so, to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and shelter the homeless are merely palliative measures without also trying to change the social order so that people can feed, clothe, and shelter themselves. It shows a lack of faith in one's fellows and in their responsibilities as children of God and the heirs of heaven. However, if you are going to try and change things, you had better have your wits about you. Now, if you're going to improve your wits, you will need to study. I was always very much impressed in reading the prison memoirs of revolutionists, such as Lenin and Trotsky, by the amount of reading they did, the languages they studied, and the range of their plans for a better social order, or rather, for a new social order.